p.m. This is Radio Ghana.
A very good evening to you, and you're welcome to Behind the News, a program which examines issues from the perspective of newsmakers and experts. My name is Agatha Samoa, and tonight, government defends imposition of tax on private universities. So exactly how much tax are they going to pay henceforth? Private universities protest tax on their operations, but while some think they should pay, others think it will have serious consequences on students in these universities. So what next? And security, after the Supreme Court verdict, the police say it is on top of the game. Join me in the next hour as we delve into these issues. Your comments and contributions are welcome on 0240 971087, 0240 971087. It's Behind the News, live on Radio Ghana in Accra, also live on Obonu FM 96.5 in Tema, Radio Central 92.5 in Cape Coast, Twin City 94.7 in Takoradi, and Sunrise FM 106.7 in Kofoja. Security issues have occupied the front burner in our national discourse, probably because of the alleged volatility of the country in the aftermath of the Supreme Court verdict pronouncing a winner in the petition hearing. Hardly a day passes by without a commentary or pronouncement on the need to foster peace and fruitful coexistence among the people. But is peace achieved just by talking about it? Acting to ensure peace at all times is as equally important as talking about it. One institution that would be seriously challenged to protect the country's peace now and beyond is the Ghana Police Service. For years, the service has come under attack for what many perceived to be their biased approach to public disturbances and employing heavy-handedness to quell disputes, misunderstandings, and riots. But if recent concerns are anything to go by, then what we have ahead of us may be the most challenging of all the tasks the police have undertaken for years. Now on the line to help us understand how prepared the police would be for the arduous tasks before us is the Director General of the Ghana Police Service in charge of operations at the headquarters, COP John Kudalo. Good evening, COP Kudalo.
Good evening, my sister.
And you're welcome.
Thank you.
Well, the police service had scaled at difficult and challenging problems in the past, but I'm sure you agree with me that should anything untoward occur after the Supreme Court verdict, it would be a Herculean task because of the stakes in this verdict, wouldn't it?
Yes, it will. You know, as we've been saying, this is an event also that we are prepared for because we know it is coming. We may even know the time it will occur. So we've started preparing so we can be able to fine-tune our rough edges, and when we find that there are some gaps, and it's everything's organization. As Nkrumah said, organization ties everything. So we started organizing our men as we did in previous events. And so we are ready to contain any situation. We've looked at the variables, the possible scenarios, and we are preparing towards them. We've been touring the regions to test the preparedness of our men in the region. So far, we've been to Kumasi, been to Kofodia, we've done the one for the Accra region, the National Headquarters Operations. So we are on course, and come the day of the verdict, I think we shall be on full gear.
When you talk about the fact that you are preparing, exactly what are you putting in place to ensure that the country remains intact after the verdict is announced?
Yeah, foremost, it's mostly going to be a public order management problem, which we are prepared for, for our operational units and the units tasked in maintaining, managing public order, all being geared up. They're undergoing their training with the various implements and equipment for managing public order. And then we have what we call the force continuum. So we are preparing for each scenario and the equipment that goes for it, and then the numbers that goes with it. And this time, you know, numbers are going to count. So I'm ensuring that we marshal our forces, and where it's necessary that other agencies can do it, like the fire service, and consultation with them, we've met and we're preparing for the event because we all know it is going to come. So we are preparing for it. But I may not be able to give you the details. That one, I don't think I'll give the details that we are preparing.
You are not ready to give the details yet, but you are preparing.
Yes, because I mean, so I think the newspapers were in Kofodia with my boss, the IG, of the papers that were there to check the equipment and the men, and then the strategies we are adopting. We are working on the scenarios. We always look at worst scenarios. That's the best way to prepare. So that's exactly what we are doing.
But at least the public would want to know exactly what you are doing in terms of...
What I'll tell the public is that the Mazarese are short. They've given us the mandate to protect life and property. And that's exactly what we are going to try to achieve.
But then, if you listen to
and also, of course, maintain law and order.
All right. If you listen to my introduction, you might have heard me talk about allegations against the service of biasness when dealing with disturbances. How are you trying to shed that tag and remain neutral, firm, and fair?
I think you've seen it yourself. We've gone through some few events, at least the elections were there, and some other public management events in which we have been involved. We have always tried to be neutral. We are the people's police. We are there to protect the law-abiding and peaceful people of this country who are working within the framework of the law. If you don't fall foul of the law, we are not going to pick and choose. I want to interpret the mandate given to us in its letter and spirit without shifting any post and without any color or anything at all.
So you are saying that you are going to be fair and firm to all sides?
Exactly.
But then, do you have enough men and logistics for this task?
Yes, no police station they will have enough as it was. I think we have adequate equipment. We have modern equipment. Fortunately, we passed out a lot of thousands of men to join our fold. And we are mobilizing and then strategizing accordingly as the police number numbers. So we try to marshal the numbers. We have people in the offices. Some of them have to come and join their counterparts because we are all policemen foremost. We shall do our best. And I think the good people of this country too who assist. I know people, most of us are law-abiding, and they'll go by the decision.
You know, I asked this question because during the election petition hearing, the service came out with a statement that because of the deployment of several of your men at the Supreme Court, there were not enough men for other duties and functions.
Yes, that was said. But this is an event we know how crucial it is. And I'll bet you means I'll get the men to do the policing.
So Ghanaians should be rest assured that you'll be on top of any eventuality now and in the weeks to come.
Yes, we shall be. And we employ all Ghanaians to be law-abiding and to be very peaceful as we all have to accept the verdict. And if we do that, I don't think there will be any need to complain about any police action.
But then how are you involving the public in your preparations?
Yes, we are going to embark on a public education any moment from now, as we did during the elections, then the public the crucial role they have to play by remaining law-abiding, going about their peaceful duties, and not doing anything untoward. We are going to meet some religious bodies, we're going to meet some chiefs. We've already met the Peace Council. And then all the stakeholders will be contacted and then also asked to talk to their men and supporters.
COP John Kudalo, we want to thank you for your time with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
COP John Kudalo is the Director General of the Ghana Police Service in charge of operations at the headquarters. And the security organization WANEP has been monitoring the temperature in the country and has come out with its second quarter report for this year, dubbed the Human Security Report. It covered the months of April, May and June. Highlights of the report include recommendations for the judiciary and the police to be fair but firm in the discharge of their duties. Greater Accra and the Ashanti regions particularly came up for mention due to their political volatility. Therefore, security patrols in the two regions should be intensified. Well, let me pause here and go to the lines as we listen to the detailed report from the horse's own mouth. And Emmanuel Bombandi is the Executive Director of WANEP. Good evening, Mr. Bombandi, and you're welcome.
Hello, good evening, madam, and good evening to all your listeners.
Well, what exactly did your report capture in the months of April, May, and June with regard to the security situation in the country?
Thank you, madam. First of all, just to make the introduction again, the ONEP Human Security Report, which is coordinated by ONEP Ghana, looks at all the incidences that occur during the quarter. And using those incidences, we are able to do a quantitative analysis of peace and security by combining the incidences we've captured in terms of the numbers, which is the quantity, and putting that against the qualitative report, which basically understands the context of peace in our country. And for this particular quarter, it is true that we have mentioned the issues related to an increase in armed attacks, because when we compare this quarter to the previous quarter, we see that in some regions, armed attack, for example, has doubled. And that is the case of Ashanti, in which in the first quarter, we recorded 4 major armed attacks. And in this particular quarter, we're talking about 8. So this civil society monitoring is open source, but its purpose is to support COP Kudalo and his men and women by helping them to do the analysis and by also drawing their attention to how we have seen the areas that require their attention. And we then try to engage them in how we support and their work for the peace of our country.
And why did you single out Greater Accra and Ashanti as places not safe to live? It must be worrying.
We just simply based it on the analysis of the data. If you looked at the first quarter, January, February, March, there were a total incidences of 30 that we recorded in Greater Accra. And if you look at the current quarter that we are talking about, April, May, June, Greater Accra, we are talking about a total of 26, which is basically quite close. If you take Ashanti, the first quarter we recorded a total of 15 incidences. And in this quarter, we are talking about a total of 21. But let me clarify here that when I talk about total, we are looking at various indicators that include accidents, that include arrest and detention, the disasters that have occurred, and so on and so forth. So you can understand that when you look at disasters alone, because of the burning of our markets, you will definitely see an increase of incidences, because most of these burnings took place in Kumasi and Accra. But for the purposes of this discussion, I think your interest is more in areas related to armed attacks, particularly civil unrest, and that's why I've singled out armed attacks, and I've said that in Ashanti, the figure doubled in this quarter, and in Greater Accra, armed attacks actually in the first quarter recorded 0, but in this particular quarter, we talked about 3. And to that extent, if you look at the quantitative data, these two regions stand out for mention. And also because they are the middle two cities, and because these are also the cities with the type of volatility that require constant attention.
Well, Mr. Bondwan, the North we know is a political hotbed. Did you monitor any security threats coming from the North?
Absolutely, because do not forget that these incidences are open source. In other words, these are incidences that have been recorded and carried in our news, including your news agency. Now, in the same way, we have been monitoring the three northern regions. But it will interest you to know that, whereas it is very easy to make reference to the three northern regions in terms of the issues that pertain to violent conflicts, in this particular quarter, you will notice that the issues around which there have been violence have been well managed in terms of responses, to the extent that there has been dialogue and mediation efforts by the communities in the first quarter who had particular problems to deal with. And the violence immediately subsided with the level of peace, confidence, and trust building increasing by the day. And so it will interest you to know that the three northern regions, for example, are doing very well in this quarter in terms of the incidences that we have been talking to, we have been discussing. Whereas in the two major cities, which coincide with Ashanti and Greater Accra, the story is the opposite.
So having identified all these, what would you want government and the security services in particular to do?
First of all, madam, it draws our attention to the argument that we have always made. Our peace and our security, number one, requires our collective effort in support of our men and women in the front line, the police service. And so this type of human security reports then help the people of Ghana to see peace and security as something that also requires their contribution, their support in enhancing the work of the police. Secondly, it draws our attention to the fact that when you talk about peace and when you talk about security, it is not something you take for granted on any day. We must continue to work at it, particularly because today as we speak, we are in a region that is very volatile with new threats that are pervasive. And here, take for example religious extremism that is weighing heavily from the Sahara into the Sahel belt and literally surrounding our country. And when we make studies, what we have observed is that in a country that the citizens are vigilant about their peace and security, it is very difficult for that security to be compromised. But where the people themselves take their security for granted, or they think that their security is something that is given to them only by the agencies of the state, they are sometimes surprised that even in their same communities, people embed themselves as if they are part of the community and turn around to help them. So, madam, secondly, as I have underscored, the purpose of this report is to keep all of us awake and vigilant, because we are monitoring the indicators, we are monitoring the incidences. And when something like that occurs, then we are easily able to look at the data, we look at the trends, and we advise that let's make sure we are not taking our security for granted. Let's continue to support our men and women in uniform.
But presently, in the northern region, the police have massed up several of their men in case of any eventuality after the verdict. Does it not send wrong signals?
Let me put it this way. You see, in some of the conflicts that I talked about, in which we have seen a lot of improvement in the management of these conflicts, I wouldn't talk about reconciliation yet or resolution, but I can talk about the return to confidence building, trust building. The fact that we cannot run away from is that some of those conflicts also have very deep-rooted political undertones. And so if you look at the environment in which the polarization appears to have deepened, precisely because we have a petition in the Supreme Court that is about concluding, the police definitely are right in trying to look out for some of those areas so that you do not have a situation in which the Supreme Court verdict reopens the wounds of some of the intercommunal conflicts that also have political undertones, so that you are able to cap them and make sure that people continue to respect law and order. So I wouldn't be surprised if the police are increasing their vigilance in some of these areas you've talked about. But as our report has underscored, we have challenges in our major cities, and that is verified by the incidences we've recorded, and we need to be paying particular attention. Now, let me quickly add, madam, that we would have wished that we shouldn't be talking about any form of anxiety at all. But we must acknowledge that even after the elections were declared in terms of the results on 9 December 2012, there were incidences of violence. We believe that it is when we continue to call attention, we continue to advocate and draw attention to these issues, that the violence then can be minimized. Luckily for us, in December, violence did not go out of control because the police were able to quickly nip them in the bud. But we cannot pretend that there was no violence. And that's why at this time around, we hope that there will be nothing that will happen. But that does not mean we should not be vigilant and take the necessary steps. And this is the second argument in which we should appreciate the role that the police are playing by mobilizing their numbers in areas that they suspect there could be problems. And finally, they have intelligence reports that civil society cannot have, and they will not share those intelligence reports. So there could be other reasons why the police are in some places in their numbers that we will not know, because our human security study is purely open sources. In other words, incidences that are publicly talked about, which is not exactly what the police use. They go beyond that to have access to intelligence reports that civil society cannot have.
Well, Mr. Bombande, we want to thank you for your time with us tonight. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Emmanuel Bombande is Executive Director of ONEP. It's Behind the News live on Radio Ghana Accra. And well, let's head straight to the Otumfuo Asantehene's Palace to get a first-hand view of what the Otumfuo's Palace thinks about all these peace initiatives here and there. And Nana Bafo Asabre Kujewu Esuabedio, he's Otumfuo's Nsumankwahene. Nana Asabre, you are welcome. I'm sure I couldn't pronounce the other name well.
Yeah.
Could you pronounce it for us?
I am Bafo Asabre Kujewu Esuabedio III.
All right. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, Nana, from the point of view of the traditional authorities, peace should be cemented for the sake of future generations. Don't you think so?
Yeah, there should be peace. It is as simple as ABC. Ghana needs peace, notwithstanding one's political background. Ghana is for us all. Therefore, we must preach peace. Already, the Peace Council have already started preaching peace. The religious bodies are also preaching peace. It means Ghana needs peace. What we should think about is Ghana first. Now, when we talk of peace, peace is very essential. Now, concerning Supreme Court's judgment on the issue, that the petitioners petitioning the Supreme Court. Now, what we are all saying is we need peace. And so first, all the stakeholders, religious bodies and other chiefs, opinion leaders are preaching peace. We need peace. Ghana is for us all, I've already indicated. We cannot say that the Cote d'Ivoire, the Togo and others are our country. Our country is Ghana. Therefore, it is important that all the political parties should, in any way, accept the verdict of the Supreme Court, because we have believed in them. That is why they spent so many days, so many energy, in deciding on the petitioners that issue. Therefore, whilst we are preaching peace, it is important that everyone accept the verdict of the Supreme Court. It's very simple.
Well, Nana, we know Otumfuo has been working hard with the other bodies and personalities to sustain the peace in our country, and if you've spoken to him, what do you get in terms of his feelings towards peace?
Well, speaking in my capacity, I will speak to him. But what I know, my overlord, is also about peace, as you are all aware. He's also preaching peace. And I think that should be the important issue among organists. I cannot speak for my overlord, but I think you are all aware that so far as I should remind you, the KNUST, what happened there when other stakeholders were preaching peace? In fact, he spoke about peace. Therefore, we need peace.
Well, Nana, Ashanti has been identified by a peace, or by peace builders, of becoming one of the troublesome areas to live in, or troublesome spots in the country. What is Nana, or what has Nana been saying about this, and what is being done so that Ashanti will be a place to live in without any trouble?
Ashanti is a peaceful city. In fact, we respect our king. Whatever he says is what Ashantis want. And he's also always preaching peace. Otumfuo, Ashantis, we respect him. Whatever he says is what we want. Therefore, Ashanti cannot be spotted as a violent city. We don't I won't in any way assent to that. Ashanti is a peaceful city because Ashanti is the only city in Ghana which comprises of all the ethnic groups who moves around peacefully without any hindrance. So I will not, I repeat, say that or agree that Ashanti is a violent city. No. It is a big no. If our king says we should sleep, we will help to that. We respect him.
All right, Nana, we want to thank you for your time with us tonight.
Thank you.
Nana Bafo Asabre Kudewesu Abebio Eza Utunfos Insuman Kwahene. It's Behind the News live on Radio Ghana in Accra. It's Behind the News live on Radio Ghana in Accra. And we move on to our next story. They used to be exempted from corporate tax payment, but this relief, which until recently private universities do enjoy, has been lifted. This follows the amendment of the Internal Revenue Act 592, replaced with Act 859, with the aim of bringing private universities into the tax net. But this development seems to have touched the nerves of managers of these universities, describing the move as detrimental to the interests of tertiary education. So what informed government's decision to amend the tax, and what are the probable effects this move is going to have on private tertiary education? Let's go to the phone lines and speak to managers of these private universities. And with us on the line is Professor Kwesi Iyanka, who is president of Central University College, and then Chairman of the Conference of Heads of Private Universities of Ghana. Good evening, Prof, and you are welcome.
Good evening, thank you so much.
Well, Prof, corporate tax is not new to many business entities, but why are private universities against it?
Well, private universities have not necessarily been against it. Private universities are of two types. One category is for profit, private universities. Those are the universities that are limited by liability.
Prof, could you raise your voice a bit? We can hardly hear.
Could I raise my voice? Okay. I'm saying that there are two categories of private universities. One category is limited by liability, and they are for profit. The other category is limited by guarantee, and they are non-profit private universities, and they are just like charitable organizations. Many of them are faith-based organizations owned by churches and so on and so forth, that are not intended to be profit-making. And when at the end of the year there are any surpluses in their accounts, these surpluses are plowed back into the development of that particular university, and the monies do not go into anybody's pocket. Those have been exempted from taxation all along. And particularly in the year 2009, there was a Supreme Court ruling that clearly identified those categories of private institutions, private education institutions, saying that they should be considered as not or as exempt from tax. It is this tax exempt status that has been revoked or reversed in the past few months that we are talking about.
So how is this imposition of these tax affect your interest exactly?
Oh, certainly it does. Private universities, of course, are playing a very crucial role, a very critical role in the tertiary educational sector. And many of these institutions we are talking about are not like 40-year-old institutions. Many of them are 3-year-old, 4-year-old, maximum of about 12 years old, and so on and so forth. They are young infant industries, just like any industry that is of crucial importance to the economy, is protected and allowed to grow to maturity before you determine whether or not to tax them. Having been considered so critical in the economy, one would have expected that the government would continue supporting us and protecting us against taxation until much later. But here we are, to be suddenly slapped with a situation where we have to be paying taxes And we are saying that this is very detrimental. What originally we would have expected government to do was to have given us access to state largesse and benefits and privileges like public universities have been having, access to the GET Fund for infrastructure, access to scholarships, access to fellowships for our staff who are seeking to do doctoral degrees and so on and so forth. So we have been fighting for equity all along, just like public universities have enjoyed those facilities. And now, if we are not going to be given these facilities, the least anybody was expecting was depriving us of the few amenities, so to say. The only privilege left that we had was tax exempt status. If this goes away, then we are completely done. That's why we are crying.
All right, Prof, I'll ask you to hold the line for us. The chairman of the Select Committee of Education in Parliament, Masias Poza, has joined the discussion. Good evening, Mr. Poza, you are welcome.
Thank you.
Well,
I'm just coming from the lecture that we had in town.
That's okay.
So I didn't hear the Prof's line of argument, but I'll just contribute what I can.
But what really informed the amendment of this act to get private universities to pay corporate tax?
To the best of my knowledge, I believe that as part of government's effort to glean as much taxes as possible from wherever possible, just to increase the tax, broaden the tax net, in order to really get the resources that we need so badly. So I think it's just part of the whole scheme to improve on the tax collection in the country.
But then,
remember, we are people are still the telephone companies are at war, and we have to look at a way of increasing the existing financial boom of the country.
But as policy makers, have you thought through the likely effect of this action on the private universities?
Definitely, my dear. We know very well that it's going to increase fees, if nothing at all, because the proprietors cannot absorb this themselves. It has to pass down just like any other goods that you are selling. If you tax it, it's the consumer that pays for it. So we are quite aware. But, you know, it's like we're trying to find ways of really increasing the income that we need so much.
You said definitely school fees are going to increase, but are you not worried because how many of these ordinary Ghanaians could afford fees of these private universities?
With all respect, you know, already these fees are high. And let me just come in to say that there are as many as 43 tertiary institutions in this country offering degree and HND programs. And some are really charging very, very fantastic fees, which, to be frank, is not, the ordinary Ghanaian cannot afford. But we are making it anyway. So I think that it's just the beginning. I know we'll, as usual, we'll adjust to it with time. But as you've already said, or Prof has said, we all know what the private institutions are doing to this country as far as tertiary education is concerned. Without them, I don't know where we would have been by now. But even with support, the streets are still filled with a lot of qualified people who haven't got places. But I think it's still also still important for us to try to get something, because some really are making lots of money. I know some of the universities are quite established and doing a lot of good work, They are in areas that the public universities are not covering enough. So I think they are necessary.
All right, so we want to thank you for your time with us tonight.
Yeah.
Matthias Poza is the chairman of the Select Committee of Education in Parliament. Now, coming back to you, Prof, you have the Mr. Poza there on the line. He talked about the fact that they need to widen the tax net, and again, he talked about increasing school fees. But is this going to result in a corresponding increase in your fees to offset the effect of this tax?
Well, I cannot tell. I can only say that in the interim, many of the private universities that are just about starting and would have needed considerable strong foundation are going to be weakened, and they may have to look for other means of surviving. That's the only thing I can say. I cannot predict whether this would lead to any increase in, but I can only say that it's going to prevent these young institutions from plowing back surpluses into the building of infrastructure, the setting up of scientific subjects and courses, provision of lab equipment, and I'm talking about the capital-intensive aspect of private education that nobody wants to touch. It's going to discourage many such institutions from starting those programs. And whether or not it will lead to increased fees is another question altogether.
So what exactly do you want government to do?
Simply revert to the original status quo, the status quo until May. And I pointed out that there are two categories of private institutions, private universities. The for-profit private education institutions that are limited by liability, just like any company. Somebody wants to set up a private education institution for profit. And then for the non-profit category, which I'm really referring to, like those faith-based owned by churches, where any surpluses that accrue do not go into any individual's pocket. But these surpluses are plowed back into developing the institution. That is the category I'm talking about. And they have enjoyed tax-exempt status for several years now. And I refer the minister or the parliamentary spokesperson we talked to refer to the Supreme Court ruling of 2009, which clarified the issue about this particular category of education institutions. These are just like charitable organizations. They have never been taxed anywhere. That is what is saying to us. I'm sure the government needs money, but I think there are other areas that monies can be taken other than from the very crucial part that the country needs for further development, special education. Already we are asking to be funded with the debt fund. We are not getting this. And now you are going to tax us further and preventing us from reinvesting into infrastructure and so on and so forth.
All right, Prof, I want to thank you for your time with us tonight.
You're welcome.
Professor Kwesi Yanka is president of the Central University College. And we also have on the line an economist and social policy analyst, Dr. Theo Richardson. Good evening, Doctor, and you're welcome.
Good evening.
Well, I'm sure you followed our discussions, but private universities in the country, should they pay tax or should they not?
Thanks for this opportunity to contribute to this very important subject. Following up on what Professor Yans said, he has explained clearly that there are two categories of private schools, and those that are run by the or were run by the missionaries were exempt from tax. And to be the starting point of our discussion, the point I would like to make is that we must adopt a coherent intellectual approach to dealing with this issue. And I suspect that there's a kind of desperation on the part of the government to mobilize revenue to address the fiscal crisis. And therefore, the policies are, the approach is a it's a kind of a model. You know, the government is bungling with the policies. If you go back to education in this country, it was introduced by the missionaries from primary school, you know, to secondary school. And although there were few private schools, I've been wondering whether these primary schools were ever taxed. And even the secondary schools were ever taxed. If now we want to tax all private institutions of learning, are we going to tax the primary and even the kindergarten pre-primary schools as well, in order to ensure equity and fairness, you know, in the system of taxation? You know, so there are fundamental questions that I think have not been properly addressed. Even the categorization into those universities or institutions of higher learning that are run by the missionaries or faith, various faith, you know, and those run by individuals, I think that is also a slippery path to go, because there must be a fair and equitable basis for, you know, making this decision and exempting one category, that is a faith-based institution, from tax, you know, as against the non-faith-based institution. So in economics, what I would say is that, far as I know, taxes have an impact on any commodity that is provided. And the second point of the analysis should be a proper conversation of education, of higher education, whether it is a necessary or a necessity or a luxury. And we do know that since generally the demand for necessities or necessities or inelastic, than the demand for luxuries, taxes on necessaries usually raise prices more than taxes on luxuries. And so that will affect the demand for higher education, depending on how we categorize it.
The Internal Revenue Act 859 compels them to pay as a means of generating resources to support the state.
Yes, as Professor Yanka indicated, we have a higher law, enacted by the Supreme Court. That Supreme Court ruling, I suppose, constitutes the highest law. And this law, amendment to the law, which is Act 529 or whatever, I suspect contravenes that law, or contradicts that law. It opposes the higher Supreme Court law. This is a matter for lawyers to explain. But if there is a higher court ruling, Supreme Court ruling, which exempts all private institutions, faith-based private institutions or higher institutions of higher education from paying taxes, then this act contravenes that law, and therefore has no legal effect. But that is a matter for interpretation. But there are fundamental issues. There has been failure on the part of government or the state to provide higher education. And the private institutions might seem to have come in to fill in that role. As Prof. Yanka indicated, private institutions run, institutional higher learning, usually run on charters. And the charters mandate them to reinvest their incomes, you know, into the running of the institution by expanding assets, by funding research, you know, especially institutions that provide training in science and technology. And I think that the impact on this is going to affect the run of these institutions, if you should consider them as enterprises. Higher taxes usually always have a disincentive effect on investment and therefore on economic growth. And so I think there has not been much thinking, you know, into this policy. It reflects a certain decision on the part of government to raise revenue. Taxes are not raised merely for revenue purposes, but even for inequality, you know, reduction of poverty, and all kinds of objective. And if government needs funds, some of us, there is a thinking outside there that the state is able to mobilize a certain resources. The resources not being properly utilized. And so the government must look at its use of resources, you know, and reallocate resources more rationally and more efficiently. I think that will give us some leeway. I don't think this is the way to go. On the other hand, we need to improve the governance of these private institutions and improve the supervision of these institutions so that we can, through our monitoring system, you know, kind of monitor their incomes and how the incomes are used. It appears that Some of these institutions have become, money making mills. I do know of one institution where the management are paying themselves huge salaries. Clearly, they must be paying income taxes on their salary, but other allowances which may be tax exempt, are not therefore giving money, spend the money that they need. But they are just kind of merging the students. And compared to even the quality of tuition that is provided, there are serious questions, to be raised. So both on economic grounds and both on social policy grounds, in terms of education, I suspect that the policy is fraught, with a lot of difficulty, especially given the legal aspect as well. What we need to provide to do is to rather government to encourage more private institutions that offer training in science and technology. In South Korea, about 50% of all institutions of higher learning are privately owned or privately run, and about 50% of these private institutions are science and technology, universities or higher institutions of higher learning. This is the missing link in this country, and these are the things that we must think aloud, because this is how we can promote enterprise and employment. And so that we are going down this path, which is, I suspect, very slippery.
Well, Doctor, there are those who also think if the state has come out to tax private universities, it should also be bold to tax the churches, NGOs, and other charitable organizations to generate enough funds for the nation.
Oh, in fact, churches are social organizations limited by guarantee. They are not public making institutions.
Hello, Doc, could you reposition yourself? We can hardly hear you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, it's much better.
Yes, churches are social organizations, and they are therefore non-profit making, and we cannot tax them. They are charitable organizations, we cannot tax them. But if a private institution, the government says that a private institution has been set up for the purpose of making profit, we can just change the charter, for running all institutions of higher learning, and even all institutions, and make them non-profit making, so that we can monitor how their resources are used and make it mandatory for all institutions, educational institutions, from the kindergarten to whatever, that they plow back their extra income into expansion and provision of other community services. Okay? I agree with the government that there's anecdotal evidence out there that some institutions, including even those that provide pre-primary, kindergarten, and others, the government must admit first and foremost that this is the result of tech failure. They provide adequate infrastructure for the provision of education from the pre-primary to the university level.
All right.
Therefore, must find ways of encouraging these private institutions to do that.
All right, sir.
But we must change the charter, for operating these institutions to kind of incentivize them or as it were mandate them to cover their extra incomes into provision of more services.
All right, Doc, we want to thank you for your time with us tonight. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Dr. Cyril Richardson is an economist and social policy analyst, and Dr. Steve Mantial is a campaign coordinator of ISUDEC and is joining us on the line. Good evening, Doc, and you are welcome.
Good evening to your listeners as well.
I'm sure you've been listening to our conversation, but what will be the ramifications of the state if the state insists on taxing private universities?
Thank you very much for the opportunity to share my perspective on the matter, but I must admit that I haven't really followed the discussion on your network. But I do, all the same, have some thoughts on it. First and foremost, I think we need to recognize the fact that there are two categories of universities, private universities, those that are set up as company limited by guarantee and those that are set up as limited liability company. The difference is that any entity set up as a company limited by guarantee is actually exempt from tax. And those that are set up as limited liability companies are tax paying kind of entities. The reason we are different is that a limited liability company is allowed to make profit and share the profit to its shareholders, whereas a limited liability, a company limited by guarantee is not allowed to make profit. That does not mean that that company cannot make profit. It makes profit, but it needs to plow back the profit into its activities. Now, the question is, don't the private companies that make profit also plow back part of their profit into their activities? Yes, they do. So I think it is a distinction between the two that we need to take a look at. Maybe you want to kind of have a unified, a kind of a common rule for private universities in general, so that if we are going to make all of them come as tax exempt under the limited limited by guarantee kind of arrangement, then we know that all private universities are tax exempt because of their status, that is, limited liability. But for insofar as a company is registered as a limited liability company, I think that company ought to pay tax. If it is limited by guarantee, then it is tax exempt. That is the law. And so the granting of a general tax amnesty to private university, in my view, was a measure that was not to be permanent in nature. We do that for a number of other business entities. If you go to the free zones enclaves, we do allow companies to operate for up to about 10 years without paying any tax. We exempt them from tax payments for up to about 10 years. The essence is to nurture and grow these companies so that they can come to full maturity and be able to compete with other foreign companies that are providing similar services. In the mining and oil sectors, we do the same. We allow the companies to recover their investments, not even part, all their investments over a time period. It used to be up to about 15, 20 years upfront. Under the new rules that we adopted about a year ago, we staggered this to gradual recovery of investment costs over a period. So companies are allowed to recover up to 20% in every kind of year, so that we don't do an upfront thing that we used to do. So we realize that sometimes there is a reason why we want to provide tax incentives, and I think in the particular case of the private universities, they are providing a vital social service. Government is unable to accommodate the growing numbers of students seeking university or tertiary admission. And that is why the importance of these private universities come in. They come to augment the capacity of the state to provide tertiary education institutions. And so it makes sense, really, to be given some tax incentives to be able to deliver on this.
All right, Doctor, many thanks for your time with us tonight.
Most welcome.
Dr. Steve Mantiao is a campaign coordinator. I Sudekan, let's read some of your text messages. Rashid says, Ghana, after the Supreme Court verdict, shall be peaceful, but peace is a collective responsibility for all of us and not only our security forces. Andrew Manga says, the stability of the country must be protected by all despite our political differences. And Luke Mann says, a tax on private universities is welcome, but we are also going to push it on students. Then we should be moving forward from there. Many thanks for your text messages. And this is where we wrap up for tonight's edition of the program. Gifty Broom controlled the sounds, and my producers were Christopher Siedu, Edmund Tete, Brian Tagama, John Pobi, and Celestine Avi. Doreen Ampofu was my summarizer. My name is Agatha Samoa, and many thanks for staying tuned.